For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff, one of the co-hosts. This interview is with Matt Power. I interviewed him in February of 2013. And it's now March of 2014, and we just found out a few days ago that that Matt passed away while on assignment in Uganda for Men's Journal. So we're putting this back up as a tribute to Matt. And I also just wanted to say that I think it comes through when you listen to him, what a curious person he was, you will understand the reason why he was sort of an inspiration for a lot of writers, myself included. But what you may not get from it is just that he was one of the most generous, probably the most generous person that I have ever met, certainly in the journalism business. And there are dozens and dozens of people that feel the same way. He was just a warm and open person, and I think if you go read his writing, you'll see that comes through his curiosity about people and his love for people. So we were lucky to have him on here at all, to be able to ask him questions, and at The Atavist, we were lucky to be able to publish his writing on one occasion, but more than that, I think we were just really lucky to be able to call him a friend. So here's me and Matt.
All right, Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. Ever since the first podcast, I've been just dreaming of it.
So we should probably do like full disclosure that you're actually a past writer for The Atavist.
I am.
So this is not... There's a chance this won't be the most journalistic, hard-hitting podcast among all the ones that we've done, some of which are extremely hard-hitting.
Yeah. Right.
So first, I got to talk about this story in GQ, which is not, when we're talking right now, is not out. So maybe you should give a little brief on the story before we talk about what it is.
So I went to London to meet up with a group of urban explorers who were led by this American academic named Bradley Garrett. He grew up in California, but he got his doctorate at Royal Holloway University in London, and he wrote his doctoral dissertation in human geography, and the title of it was Place Hacking. So his idea was that infrastructure, buildings, structures, all the sort of physical accoutrements of civilization could be infiltrated, hacked, recoded in a certain way by breaking the rules and going to parts of them or getting into places that you're not supposed to go. So over 4 years before I met him, he had gone on this just insane, deep anthropological study of this subculture, where they had gone into the tube system in London has something like 14 abandoned tube stations that are not you know, currently in use, and they would walk down the tracks of the tube to get to these other stations, you know, and they ticked off every one of them. They went into like abandoned submarines that were half sunk in the mud in the Thames, and there's this 40-acre underground complex that was supposed to be where the shadow British government would operate during the event of a nuclear war. That wasn't declassified until 10 years ago or something. They like broke into it and drove the James Bond villain, you know, battery operated cars around. There was a underneath London, there's a 20-mile rail system called the Mail Rail, which was run by the Royal Mail, totally separate from the tube system.
Huh.
And it would deliver mail underneath the city. And they found their way into the system, and the trains were still running. And they drove one of the Mail Rail trains and then derailed it.
So basically they're breaking in to these places, finding their way in, either breaking in or sneaking in some capacity.
It's supposed to be low impact, and in theory you're not supposed to damage anything on the way in. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
So how did you know about these guys?
The BBC radio did an interview. Last year, the tallest building in Britain, and what was at the time the tallest building in Europe, topped out. It's called the Shard. It's this huge 1,000-foot building over London. And the day that it topped out, a bunch of photographs were sent to newspapers around London of black-masked explorers sitting on top of this building, sitting in the crane, like, you know, making, you know, obscene gestures or whatever. This group of guys had all gotten up there, walked up 1,000, you know, 75 flights of stairs and taken their pictures up on top. So Brad, who has become this kind of de facto, they call it urbex, urban exploration spokesman, you know, was on a bunch of radio and stuff. So I emailed him, and as just like incredible luck, he was a fan of and subscriber to Harper's and knew a bunch of my stories. So I sort of, you know, had a good in.
Has that ever happened before that a subject has been like, I'm actually so glad to hear from you, I'm a fan of your work?
No, it had never happened. And it was like, I kind of almost couldn't believe it, but he was like, I'm so glad you're writing this story. I was like, that is the best thing I've ever heard. I mean, it's unbelievably rare, because, you know, you often write these things into some kind of a void. I mean, now with social media and stuff, there's more feedback than there used to be, but you can write a story and never hear a word about it. You know, it's entirely possible, something you really put, you know, loved,
especially a Harper story as of like 8-10 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and quite literally, like, because, yeah, until 5 years ago, I don't think Harper's even had an online archive.
Yeah.
So
this guy, he knows your work. So he says, okay, yeah, come on. But did you have the idea from the beginning that did you say to him, like, I want to do some of this stuff, or just, I want to come profile you and hang out?
I've always gone in for these sort of interactive projects, and this was so much fun to contemplate doing the same stuff that, you know, I don't know if there'd be a really good way to do a story like this without actually going and doing some of the stuff with him. You know, there've been stories written about urban exploration before, and there's, you know, the obligatory, like, you know, evening in the catacombs or whatever. But I wanted to take it a bit of a step beyond, and I kind of wrestled with that in the story, because here's a story about a guy who has also very explicitly gone native with this group that he's supposedly documenting. And then I was, you know, in the story confronted with the same question. We're totally breaking the law, trespassing, climbed Notre Dame Cathedral.
And you actually describe in the story this sort of like journalistic ethical dilemma of sorts.
Sure.
Where you've done things like you've gone underneath London, and those things are illegal, right, technically, so there's that. But this is something, there's something also kind of like sacred about it, in addition to it being illegal. And you talk about the consequences of sort of like appearing on the front page of a French newspaper as like idiot American journalist caught like breaking gargoyle off of Notre Dame. Just that part of the story. But how much of that, was there any question that you were going to do it? Did you pause in that moment and say like, maybe I'm not going to do this?
I was nervous, but I also, I mean, I was nervous, and it was because of the cultural heritage aspect of it, you know, that it's such a fragile sort of piece of world history that we were, I didn't consider it desecration. I actually felt ultimately when, you know, from the top, I had a sense of the sacred that I don't know that I could have gotten any other way. But yeah, it's totally nerve-wracking. And I wasn't worried about getting arrested. That would have worked fine with the story. I was really worried about, like, hurting something, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would feel that way about, you know, ordinary things. You know, it's presumably just as illegal to, you know, sneak down into the underground in London. But mm-hmm. We didn't really worry about that.
Right. You're in the sewers.
Yeah.
Probably not
going to
do much.
Yeah, no. Going through the sewers of London, it would be very hard to break things, even though it's just as important to, you know, to the world history.
But this struck me as, just when I was reading, I feel like a lot of people who do this like magazine type journalism features, there's a part of it for many people where, this is especially true for me, where it's sort of like an excuse to go talk to people and do things that you would not in ordinary life get to do.
Right.
And this is the ultimate, I'm not sure I've ever read a story that has more of that in it than this. Like you literally can go to the places where if you visit Notre Dame, you can walk around on the inside and you can kind of look up at the spires and everything, but you are sitting on top of it.
Yeah.
And it's just like so immersive.
And I honestly, I couldn't resist. There was some aspect of me, which I guess is that like, that kid's sense of adventure, which I don't think I could have resisted even if I'd thought better of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is in a lot of ways probably why I became a writer, or why I got into this stuff in the first place, is because like I wanted to have the kind of life that I, you know, not to be the story exactly, but I wanted to experience the sort of limits of things, you know.
Do you talk about that actually, the opening to this story that you wrote for Harper's about taking up this like raft, homemade raft down the Mississippi? The opening of that story, you talk about sort of like how you met this guy who was a real, true kind of free spirit, and you always felt like you were drawn back to, you could do these little adventures, but then you were sort of drawn back to something more conventional.
Sure.
And then get tired of it and then go out again. Is that how you got, I mean, is that how you got into journalism in the first place?
I mean, I think it was that love of wanting to both do things and then to tell stories about them. I don't know if it was not exactly like seeking for a higher truth, but really wanting to just have the experiential aspect of it be sort of overwhelming. And actually, it's funny. The raft story is the story that Brad Garrett, the urban explorer guy, had read and known of mine before.
That makes sense.
And you know, and that was a similar story. Like I had met this guy while I was hitchhiking on the coast of California, and he ended up years later looking for a crew for this raft that he had built in Minneapolis to sail down the river. And that turned into probably one of the most one of the most first person stories I wrote, where I really had to, there's no way to be like a neutral observer on a raft because you're all sort of on it together, and mm-hmm. you know, you're part of it. You can't step to the side and pare your nails and be like, you know, making an objective study of the raft anarchists. And that seemed to be the best way to handle it, was to, you know, to just give in and be a character. With this GQ one, I felt like I was less, I mean, I was more on the sidelines sort of watching, but I was going wherever they went, you know. And so at a point, you can't help but be experiencing it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a spectrum of that kind of stuff. I've written other stories where I'm only present in the most you know, liminal kind of way where you're sort of standing off to the side and really letting it be about other people. And I think that each story has its point along that spectrum that you have to approach. Like, mm-hmm. I don't always want to be the swashbuckling idiot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to be that sometimes because it's fun and suits certain stories. And then other stories, it just doesn't belong at all.
Did you, in the GQ case, did you sit down with an editor beforehand and sort of like, here's who to call if you hear that I'm in London prison?
I think they knew that I had done enough sorts of stuff like this before that I would basically know what I was getting into. But I really didn't even know the depth of what I was getting into. When I arrived, and you know, anyone who reads the story will get to this pretty quickly. Garrett was arrested the morning I arrived, and so I was left waiting at the airport for him while he was, unbeknownst to me, in jail, being interrogated by the police for a totally different place that he had hacked into, which was this underground World War II era bunker beneath the streets of London that had been hired out as a secure file storage warehouse by this American company. So it very rarely in a story will you have a lead handed to you on a silver platter the moment you arrive in the country. It usually doesn't work that way.
You had a couple of reporting strokes of good fortune in this.
Yeah. You do have that, I think in your other podcast, Chris Jones called it the ka-ching moment. And I always thought of it more as this, like, you just have a moment when you're talking to someone where your storytelling neurons start firing and you realize that, like, that the goods are being acquired. You don't necessarily know that you have them, but you know that they're in the air. And because there's a very, I've never gotten to a point as a writer where I didn't feel absolutely sick to my stomach when I started out reporting a story. You know, mm-hmm. I did a piece for Men's Journal in 2008. There was this mountaineering disaster on K2. 11 mountaineers got killed. I somehow, with a single day's notice, persuaded my editor to fly me to Islamabad, Pakistan, assuming that I was going to be able to talk to these people when they came out.
So you heard that it happened.
Yeah.
Called an editor, said, I got to go tomorrow.
Yeah. $6,000 plane ticket. And they flew me. And I literally arrived, and I spent, you know, it's a two-stage, like, 16-hour flight to get to Islamabad. You stop in London. I spent the entire flight over there hating myself for having agreed to do this and, like feeling physically that, you know, that pit of your stomach, like, I'm going to, you know, screw the pooch on this. Like, there's no way I'm going to get this story.
And they spend all this money on it already.
And they spent all this money. I kind of couldn't believe I did it. And then I got there. My only contact was this fixer that a friend had put me in touch with. Within an hour of landing, I had met all of my main characters. Like, there happened to be a press conference going on when I landed, and we went straight to it. Basically, from going to Pakistan, I filed the story a month later. It was an 8,500-word story.
It's like a quick turnaround.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
So, wait, take me through your... What's your kind of approach to people, you know, your sort of initial approach? Like, I feel like some people take the kind of like, I'm here to tell your story and I'm going to do it in a really fair way. And other people sort of kind of come at it as like, I climb mountains too. I know what you've been through sort of thing. Like, do you have a sort of standard way you approach a source? I mean, they've just come out of a disaster. So now you got to persuade them to talk to you.
Yeah. And this was, I mean, in this circumstance, there were enough people who wanted their story to be told. And I mean, one of the hardest kind of stories, as you know, as I know, to get into is one that's like a media clusterfuck,
mm-hmm.
You know, and where you're trying to elbow your way not only past other, you know, long form magazine writers and stuff, but like the bookers from the Today Show and all of those kinds of people, you know, when there's like, you know, diving into a story like that is terrifying, and you're almost never going to get anything good. So on a certain level, you have to know when to back off and not try and get a big, huge breaking story, because if we don't break stories in that way, with this kind of writing.
And a lot of people are also, I mean, a lot of those people are dangling money in various ways in front of the people, you know, whether they're
money
from TV
and,
or...
and all sorts of various subterfuges. And so the only times I've ever gotten really into stories like that were big breaking media things is like Katrina. Like I went for Harper's after that. And what I ended up writing was essentially media criticism because it was about, you know, this swarm of attention, of media attention that was descended on New Orleans, having not really cared about New Orleans before, and how quickly it also sort of dissipated. So I ended up writing about the Times-Picayune and the newspaper of the town that was there before and was there after, which was, I think, it just struck me in that case as the only sort of way to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to be beating people to the, you know, human interest story that every journalist was, you know, and watched the coverage of something like Newtown. I mean, you can't even imagine the idea of, like, having to go to Newtown and get a story is, I would rather quit being a journalist, you know, it's just not, although those people were being harassed by every satellite truck in the Northeast, you know. With approaching people, you know, especially people who have had some sort of traumatic thing, part of it is timing, you know, and it doesn't always work. And part of it is just approaching them as a human, you know, and like giving them a reason to trust you, which has to do with like actually caring about what you're reporting on, you know. And I think, I don't know, I mean, I've always just liked people and I'm intensely curious about people who are interested in things or have stories to tell. So I always do really want to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. I would guess people can mostly tell the difference between someone who's approaching them in a more exploitative way. Although,
yeah,
you know, it's all exploitative in some grander sense, but
or transactional or something like that. But with the kind of stuff we do, it's not as it's. I mean, this feels less of a transactional kind of journalism than the TV thing, because what you're really offering someone is just a chance, you know, and people do really want to tell stories, like almost always, even the worst, like things that happen, like people want to talk. It's a matter of when, and presenting yourself or putting yourself forward as someone who will like do some sort of justice to them.
Mm-hmm. But you kind of had, like you lived in some kind of anarchist co-op, is that right? Or a squatter's colony? Was this before you started doing any journalism at all?
It was kind of concurrent. I moved to New York at a pretty interesting time in like 1997. I initially came to go to grad school at Columbia, and then I...
Journalism grad school?
No, it was creative writing, the MFA program, and I hated it. I dropped out after a semester and thought it was... You know, and still think that those programs are a pretty big waste of money.
The creative writing programs?
Yeah, just MFAs in general.
Well, what's your? I want to hear your.
Well, I mean, Columbia in particular is enormously expensive. They give very little funding. I think, you know, it's probably $45,000 or $50,000 a year plus living expenses. So you're talking about assuming a burden of debt unless you're independently wealthy that would essentially have prevented me from ever being able to actually do the things I've ended up doing, you know. I wouldn't have been able to, if I had $1,000 in student loans a month to pay back, gone and lived in India for 2 years or spent, you know, been a hobo and done all of the sort of fun stuff that I've gotten to do and ended up writing about. So I never regretted that. I left to do an internship at Harper's, but around that same time, I had got involved with a sort of activist, an activist scene in New York that was based around this squatted building up in the South Bronx, and I wrote an essay about that for Grant a few years ago. But we got really involved with community gardens activism and social justice, things like that. We used to have this amazing building up in the South Bronx that was there was like 10 of us living there, six stories, probably 40 apartments, totally no windows, no heat,
just
no electricity.
Abandoned.
Yeah, it had been sort of absentee landlord situation for a long time, and then eventually, like much of the South Bronx, just sort of left. But we like totally, we did. It was great, you know. We would split our own wood, build fireplaces inside it, and had a teepee where we would have peyote ceremonies in the garden, and it was fantastic. And I really loved that. So this would have been around 1999 or so, 2000, and I got involved with Earth First and a lot of environmental activism, stuff like that. But at the same time, I had been an intern at Harper's, so I was really interested in writing and journalism. And I sort of moved away from the activism side of things, also because I hated going to meetings and all of that sort of organizational aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of freelance fact-checking back then for different magazines. So that's sort of how I got into writing for stuff. But I think the first story I ever sold was to Spin magazine, and it was about a group of anarchists in outside of Eugene, Oregon, who were living in trees to keep them from being cut down. So they had built this interlocking Ewok village 150 feet in the air, and I worked so hard on that. I spent probably 3 weeks with them living in the trees and reported the shit out of it. And then Spin...
Wait, I read that piece. I think it was for Feed.
It was for Feed. What happened was my editor at Spin, who, you know, it was my first piece. I was really nervous. And, you know, it was, I don't know, like 4,000, 5,000 words long. You know, I had never reported anything before. I had never done any of that stuff before. I, like, really didn't know what I was doing. But I just was like, I'm just going to do it really hard, you know. And he, I was in a revise for it, and he quit. He quit his job. And there wasn't, the writing on the wall seemed clear that there wasn't going to be anyone who was going to pick it up, and it was just going to be dead on the vine. So I ended up selling it to feedmagazine.com, feedmag.com, I think they were called.
Yeah.
Which was like a proto Slate web.
It was the first 1.0. web magazine.
There was a brief period a couple years ago when they actually put their archive back online, and there's also the Stephen Johnson was involved with the beginning of it.
One of our someone who works at Atavis, Stephanie Simon, was one of the founders. Actually, she and Stephen.
Maybe she has my story, because I actually don't even have a copy of it.
Oh, really? She might have it.
I have like an early draft, but basically, I mean, and this was in the late '90s. You would get paid. I think I got paid 50 cents a word, which the internet does not pay now.
Yeah.
You know, you'd get paid much less to write for Slate now. A pretty sort of remarkable and obviously not a sustainable financial model at the time.
As it turned out.
But it was a great, you know, that story came out great. And another very early story of mine from that same trip was I rode freight trains from Vancouver to Toronto. So I rode across Canada, and that was for this magazine called Blue.
I liked that magazine.
Yeah, it was great. It was like a real early kind of adventure travel, but it wasn't commercial at all. Like, you know, they would do a 10-page feature about hopping freight trains, you know, which is even today pretty hard to persuade a magazine to want to do something that's like, I think I pitched a story on riding freight trains again to National Geographic Adventure when I used to write a lot for them, and the editor-in-chief said that it was too dirtbag. So my friend
That's
and I
beat.
Decided we wanted to start a magazine called Dirtbag, which would be like just the grottiest stories. I mean, I had to cut out all of the stuff about poop in the GQ piece about going through the sewers of London.
That was too dark for GQ?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could imply it, but you couldn't come right out and say it. You know, it was just fine.
You can't sell watches long inside that kind of.
You really don't. And nobody's going to want to put a perfume ad right next to that.
Yeah. So, but you, I mean, if you started with the kind of like tree sitters, which was, you know, it's not exactly what you were doing at the time, but you were in that community.
Sure.
So there's a little bit of that. Write what you know aspect to that. And then could it have gone another way? Like, were you thinking about maybe I could just, maybe I'll stay in this activist community, or you just decided, what was the point at which you said, actually, this is what I want to do. I want to go spend time with these people and write about it.
I just ended up realizing that I enjoyed the writing and the reporting and the I liked the experiential aspect of it, but I've never been much of a joiner. And so as much as I like admired and respected people who devoted their lives to like social justice activism, I thought my skills were better played out in actually sort of telling their stories rather than trying to arrange things or organize, which is why, yeah. And I mean, I guess it was kind of like a crotchety old man get off my lawn feeling I had at first about Occupy. I was like, these kids, we were doing that 10 years ago. And then I realized, you know, after a month, you know, they were really serious about it. And but I don't know if I can march like that anymore. You know, I'm fascinated by it, and I'm fascinated by the people who can really devote themselves to it. But I don't think it's my thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'd rather write about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, which requires to be somewhat distanced.
Yeah,
yeah.
And are you? I mean, speaking of sort of being a little itinerant, not a joiner, you're itinerant in terms of the magazines. I mean, look at the magazines you've written for. It's a really wide collection of places. And is that by design? Is that if someone, like, were you on contract at a certain point at different places?
Oh,
or
no.
Do you just like no. that? Or that's by necessity?
I do. I mean, I've always sort of enjoyed the challenge gamesmanship aspect of it. You know, I've never been on contract anywhere, and I've written for probably 20 different magazines, but I've always, like, my first love and the one that I've gotten to write the most sort of satisfying pieces for me has been Harper's, you know, and I think Dave Samuels in the interview you did with him was saying a lot of the same. You know, it's like having come through there when I did, which was like spring of 1998, and just so many amazing people were there at the time. You know, in the intern group before me was Tom Bissell and Ryan Lizza. In my intern group was Donovan Hone, who's an amazing writer and, mm-hmm. and editor. And then you could trace New York Publishing through that magazine and through the internship program.
Yeah, and beyond. I mean, Clara Jeffrey.
Yeah, Clara was the readings editor. No, she was, I'm sorry, Clara was the index editor. So she would be like, you know, basically like the house whip, like getting the interns to get the index statistics together. Joel Lovell, who's now like at the deputy editor at the Times Magazine, and Roger Hodge, who was my first editor there, was an assistant readings editor at the time. It was just like an incredible place.
Yeah, there's definitely like a tree that traces back to that.
Yeah,
that intern program.
So that was all to say, it was just like a very exciting time to be there. And you know, when I got my first assignment from them, which was, I was going out with a girl at the time who was a freelancer for NPR, and she moved to India, and I went there and ended up spending about over the course of 2 years, probably a year and a half in India.
Mm-hmm.
I was going back for long, like 4 or 5 month trips, and then, you know, pitching stories that I've found there, and that was really. There's so much, like the advice that I've always given to young writers who are starting out and trying to figure out how to get to do this kind of stuff. And I think it still applies even in the sort of atomized, fragmented media landscape that we live in, is to go somewhere interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And like at that time, India, Pakistan, it was super, you know, there's so much going on. Not only the stuff with the, you know, Afghan war, but just it's a fascinating culture, and there weren't a lot of journalists there.
So this was what, 2003, 2004?
Yeah, I first went in 2003, and then I went on and off until mid-2005.
So. And was that first piece for Harper's, was that about the sort of poisoned water supply?
So I had a friend who's now, this guy Vinod Jose, who's actually now the editor of Caravan, which is this sort of long-form Indian the New Yorker of India, and he introduced me to this village in Kerala, which is way down in southern India, that had been poisoned by pesticide runoff, and all these children had birth defects and really high like cancer clusters, things like that, and ended up writing this, I think, 11,000 word story for Harper's about India's struggles with modernity and sort of this intersection of culture and science and human suffering and all of that. So that was my first story for them, and after that things just sort of started rolling, you know, to the point where I'd always be working on two or three different things.
Mm-hmm. And that piece is on the other end of the spectrum. I mean, maybe you can tell me if you think it is, but from the sort of place hacking thing, which is like a little more fun, there's a serious sure. aspect to it. And I mean, that is, you know, that's the sort of like reporting about real people's suffering. Yeah. That's, you know, a lot, it's a different kind of story. Do you try to balance them? Do you want to be one of those reporters and not the other? Or do them both?
It's funny. I always wanted, you know, I do love the fun stories and the ones where you're sort of like a character and immersing yourself in another world. But I did always want to, you know, I always wanted also to tell stories that actually mattered. And I don't think I could ever entirely relinquish one for the other. So, yeah, and I mean, that's the other great thing about Harper's. And most of the stuff, I mean, I would say on that spectrum, the rafting story was the most far into the, you know, gonzo first person that I ever went. You know, my last story for Harper's was about drug-resistant malaria in Cambodia. So it was a big public health story. And that was much more, I mean, I was in the story in as much as to make clear that I was the one observing things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, and that's really like something that I think Lewis Lapham has given magazine writing, and the imprint of that, you know, it obviously grows out of the new journalism thing in the 60s, but this idea that there's nothing wrong with the reporter being a character in the story, because of course they're there watching, like almost all, you know, and that's what so many great Harper's pieces, the Dave Samuels pieces, it has to be first person. I don't think there's a way to tell it that honestly without at least being aware of your presence in it and the fact that you're affecting it in some way. Because there isn't really a way to report a story without influencing it.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, I want to go back to what your process is for writing. Just in terms of writing the lead first, writing, how do you distill
that? I'll usually, you know, there's this process and it's almost like a psychological, like stacking the woodpile process where I like, you know, because I'll come back with like a garbage bag of like indecipherable notes and like notebooks and like shit I wrote on the back of a ticket and just like put all that in a pile and then have, you know, all of this now audio stuff. And I take a lot of photographs, probably 700 photographs I took on that Urban Explorer story, just to remember every single detail, not even thinking of like composition or artfulness, but just like some funny thing a sign said or some detail, some graffiti, anything, you know, just so that you can, you know, so you can recall it when you're, I have a really good memory in general, but like having those kind of cues to bring you back to the moment that you're trying to describe. And that's such an action-driven piece where we're going through like the catacombs and the sewers and climbing buildings and, you know, all of these crazy things. Like, I wanted as much visual memory of it as I could. Mm-hmm. So the cameras and, I mean, the iPhone is incredible for that because you can record on it, you can take notes on it, and you can take hundreds of snapshots. So that, I sort of collate all of that stuff. And then I would say, like, rather, I don't write anything like a formal, and actually McPhee talks about this, I don't write anything like a formal outline, but I'll end up usually writing like a list of, you know, like a shot order, you know, like mm-hmm. the list of scenes, and sort of figure out the connective tissue and some kind of structure around that. And then, like, once that's all there, usually it has to get, you know, you get to this point late at night when it's really quiet, and then, like, that first 1,000 words drops out. And then it really comes quite fast. You know, and often that first 1,000 words is what Donovan Hone, a piece of mine he was editing, called throat clearing. You know, and you do have that, like, or the orchestra warming up. And that's something that goes back to, like, I don't know, epic poetry, where you have the invocation of the muse. You know, I'll often start a story where I'm just really writing a description of a place, you know, not even a person or something like that. So it really depends on what the story is. And I almost always write much, much longer than I'm allowed. And usually with the sort of faint hope that they won't notice and will just be like, oh yeah, 9,000 words, just like give them the whole well, you know, which is not unreasonable, I guess, from one perspective. I'm sure there's far more efficient methods that could be done in, like, the whole reporting and writing process, but I've never figured them out.
What's your sort of approach to the business, your business of freelancing? You know, you're living in New York. You don't seem to have taken a lot of assignments. Your assignments seem to follow your interests rather than sort of you're piecing together. I don't know, maybe do like ad copy stuff on the side. I'm curious how you sort of view making a living at this particular.
You know, I guess I don't, because the kind of stories I've gotten to do have involved basically fulfilling all of my childhood fantasies of adventure, like having an adventurous life. I've never felt, even though you don't make a ton of money doing it, I've never felt that I was missing out on something. You know, I haven't worked in an office since a 2-week stint as a fact checker at House and Garden magazine in 2001 was the last time I worked in an office. So that's 12 years. And I haven't starved to death yet. And I'm fine, you know, but I've also always lived in very sort of weird or you know, flexible situations. You know, I lived for a long time in like an artist collective where I lived in a windowless crawl space, and I think it was $350 a month or $375, something like that. You know, New York is a hideously expensive until you're willing to do some really weird things, and then it's not that bad. Now it's obviously a bit more stable, and I'm married, and my wife's also a freelance journalist, but we have our own place, and, you know, we just sort of make things work, you know, and it's fine. And I wouldn't trade getting to do what I do for the compromises that you'd have to make to be, like, totally stable and, you know.
Yeah.
But you do get faced with choices. I have no idea in the world how I could afford having a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Or, like, the time to have a kid, all of that.
Yeah, I feel like people ask about that. That's a big concern for people, especially if you find newspaper journalists who want to go freelance, or, you know, they're concerned, like, well, how do I make this living doing this? And your answer to that is basically you've kind of, like, built your life around that. So live cheaply when you have to live cheaply. It's more like adjusting to the reality of checks coming. You know,
yeah, don't, you know, I mean, I think there's also probably a lot of there, and being married to another freelancer is, like, you know, obviously complicates that negotiation. I think some people have a partner who's, you know, whatever, a lawyer or something, like, does some totally different thing. And that's one way of making it work too, of course. I guess for me, it was just literally not really caring about that money aspect of it, you know, and figuring that things were going to sort themselves out. But it has to be something that you're constitutionally able to do, because I think it would be terrifying if it was something that made you really anxious. You'd be very, very unhappy. Because
mm-hmm.
you might get a check for 10 grand, but you might have to wait 2 months before the next check comes, you know, or more, very easily. So it's like it's just all a balance. I wouldn't want to be my 24-year-old self that I was. Like, I don't know if New York is that kind of a place now either. Like, I don't know that you can come move to New York and live in a squat and be a sort of wandering thing and then just start writing. Like, I feel like I was lucky to have arrived at the time I did, and I would be anxious if I was just trying to start that now. Mm-hmm. But there's no way to tell if it's really different or not.
People are doing it.
Yeah. The people who are going to do it are going to do it regardless, I think, you know. So it has more to do, I think, with temperament than even historical circumstances in
mm-hmm.
a way.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. You got to write for us again.
I will.
That's the deal.
Thanks for listening to the Longform Podcast. The Longform Podcast is edited by Lauren Kirchner. And special thanks to our intern, Sarah Amandolare. And check out Matt Powers' Atavist piece called Island of Secrets, if you get a chance. I'm Evan Ratliff of Atavist. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform. See you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.